Today's Teisho will be on case 83 in the Book of Serenity. 83 is entitled Dao Wu Tends the Sick. Introduction. The whole body being sickness, Vimalakirti is hard to cure. The grass being usable for medicine, Manjushri uses it well. How can that compare to calling on a transcendent person and gaining peace and well-being? Case. Guishan asked Dao Wu, "Where are you coming from?" Dao Wu said, "I've come from tending the sick." Guishan said, "How many people were sick?" Dao Wu said, "There were the sick and the not sick." Guishan said, "Isn't the one who is not sick you, ascetic Ji?" Dao Wu said, "Being sick and not being sick have nothing to do with him at all. Speak quickly, speak quickly." Guishan said, "Even if I could say anything, it would have no relation." Verse. When has the wonderful medicine ever passed his mouth? Even the miraculous physician can't hold his wrist. As though existent, he is basically not non-existent. Utterly empty, he is basically not existent. Not perishing, yet born, alive without dying. Completely transcending before prehistoric Buddhas, walking alone after the empty eon, subsisting peacefully. Sky covers, earth supports. Moving on, the sun flies, the moon runs. So today is day 3 of our wonderful spring sesshin, and I want to thank everybody for really excellent practice this morning. People are sitting very, very still and coming into the Dokusan room with wonderful responses, really deep, deep engagement. You know, it's really, really fantastic to sit with people who practice so wholeheartedly. It's really wonderful. And so please keep up the good work. You know, it's definitely the case that, you know, Zen practice feels better, right? I mean, you feel better when you do it. And it's worth asking, what is it about Zen practice that makes you feel better, right? And so this koan is really talking about that in a very acute, very astute, rather, way. You know, I have not had too many experiences of death in my life, but I've had a number of them, right? Of sickness, we say, you know, sickness, old age, and death. All of us are going to be subjected to sickness, old age, and death. There's a wonderful artist, Marcel Duchamp. I don't know if you know Marcel, but he is a wonderful, wonderful artist, and his career is really interesting to me. And he did a very painting called "Nude Descending a Staircase," and it's quite wonderful to see. And he has quite a few other really interesting works. And on his tombstone, it says basically something like, "Death is what happens to the other guy." You know, I think that's true, right? I mean, I alone am not going to die. I alone am not going to get sick, you know. You know, I've certainly had my share of even though not too many, I've had my share of seeing people die and sickness, right? When I was a kid, I got scarlet fever, And I don't know how I got it, but I was about 11 years old, and my parents just thought I had caught some bug. And I got sicker and sicker, right? And I was in bed for like a week, and they finally called the doctor, and the doctor came in, and I had like 105 fever, and he said, "This is not a normal, your son is not, this is not a normal bug, you know." And they took me to the hospital, and I had scarlet fever. And I remember just being not afraid at all, right? I mean, I actually was just like, it was just kind of like a dreamy experience, right? I was not all with it, but it wasn't like I was terrified that I was going to die. I admit I was just a little kid. But, I was just sort of going along with the experience, right? Luckily, I got some antibiotics, and they pulled me through, you know. But I've seen other people also dying, you know, or on the edge of death. My father, my brother had a bone cancer. He's one. My brother died of bone cancer when he was 50. My father died when he was 69 of lung cancer. And, I hadn't seen my father much. We had some tensions over the years, but when he got cancer, I started driving down to D.C. to see him. And, he was genuinely terrified of dying. Right? It was really, like, terrifying to him. And he felt so cheated. And he just felt totally cheated. He had worked all his life and not necessarily enjoying his work. And his plan was that he was going to retire when he was 70, but he was sort of like forced out of his job when he was like 65 or something like that. And, he sort of had been looking forward to retirement. Now he wasn't. He died at 69. And when I went to see him, he was just like so agitated. He's so bitter. Felt cheated. And he had spent a lot of time looking for a solution. Right? There must be some way to beat this thing. And there was no way to put his mind at rest, it seemed. I've known other people who also died in various ways. My brother had long painful experience of, there are some forms of cancer, bone cancer now, that can be cured, but there are some that are incurable, and this was quite a while ago. This was like 20 years ago. So, my sister-in-law said that basically their house became like a hospital. There was all these medicines and all these devices and hospital bed and when I myself saw him, I was hoping he would make it, but I knew he wouldn't make it, So anyway, we're all going to have this happen to us, right? This is inevitable. And I had this experience that I've talked about before when I was much younger, and it stayed with me. It's really resonated with me. It's one of the reasons I got interested in Zen. When I got out of college, I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I had a series of jobs. Like I worked in college. I put myself through college in the summers working as a carpenter. And first a carpenter's assistant and then a carpenter. And I actually liked building trades a lot. I enjoyed, it's very hard work. You come home at the end of the day, you're just wiped out. But you know, building things is nice. It's very nice to see something go up. It's a beautiful, you look, you know, it's very impressive. You know, when you're done, you know, I built that. That's something else, you know. And but I did that, and then there was an economic downturn, so I had a number of other jobs before I went to graduate school. And one of the jobs I had was working for the Mayflower Moving Company. You know, so I was moving furniture, which was actually like a job I enjoyed a lot. You know, you don't have to do any thinking. There's very little stress. You know, you just move furniture all day, you know. And I was in good shape, so I could, you know, I could do it, you know. And so one of the things that would happen was that we would get a call to go out someplace, you know, or the place where I was, main building, the main warehouse was in Charlottesville, Virginia. And we would get a call, and if you were chosen to go on the call, you get paid. You're on the clock the whole time you drive out there. And then you load up the car, the van, and you drive it to like North Carolina, right, or something. And you're on the clock the whole time. So you're getting paid just riding around in the moving van. It wasn't a lot of money, but it was nice to be paid for just riding, right? And you go into the restaurant, meals were on the Mayflower Company. You know, so I felt like I was, you know, a king, you know, at the time. And but we had this job. We got called out to this place where this woman had called us to help with unpacking some crates. And the man who it turns out that there was an old couple, an old man and his wife. And when we came to the house, they were outside of Charlottesville, Virginia, in a very nice like place. It was like a pretty house out in the country, and it was looking out over a lake. And when we came in, you know, I think I was 21 years old. And we came into this house, and it was nice house, nothing special. And we went through this, it must have been like this guy's studio, I guess, but he had a four-poster bed, and the bed had been put on books. Each of the posts, they had made stacks of books, and they put the four-poster bed on some of these books to elevate the bed, right? And from the bed, you could see out at the lake, and there was this old man in the bed. And he was, it turns out, an artist, right? He was a painter. And he had gone to Europe, I guess, for a long time, and our job was to uncrate these paintings. They had been stored, stacked and stored in these wooden boxes. And the paintings had special paper between, they were oil canvases, oil paintings, unframed, right? So there were just these layers of paintings with separating paper between each of the paintings in these crates. And our job was to uncrate them. And the problem was that they had been, this man had gone all over the world. When we were unpacking his work, he had paintings. He had gone to like Nepal, right? He had, you know, he was a realist painter, right? So sort of impressionist painter, really. I shouldn't say realist, sort of impressionist painter. And he had paintings of like Nepal, India. You know, he had obviously gone all over Asia. These were, you know, large paint, most of these were large paintings, like, you know, three feet almost, or some of them were 2 feet, 3 feet by whatever, two and a half feet, and they were beautiful. You know, he was not an innovator, but he was a really competent sort of, he almost looked like something you would see in the 19th century, right? This sort of impressionistic, realistic painting. And he obviously had really good training. He was a good draftsman. Everything was proportioned right. He was a kind of old-fashioned painter, but really excellent, you know. And these had been stored in a warehouse, I guess, in New York. And this was like his insurance policy, right? His old age, his retirement plan was to, you know, pull these paintings out of boxes and sell them through his dealers. And they had gotten wet. So he must have, you know, been traveling all over the world and, you know, basically shipping these back and thinking, okay, you know, this is my plan. I'm going to go be old and I'll pull these off the stack and have them sold, and, you know, basically I'll be a happy old man. But they had gotten wet in New York and shipped down to Virginia, and our job was to unpack them. And you know, as we unpacked them, the woman was in, I can only think now how difficult that was, you know, for her, you know, to go through that process, because, you know, she clearly, you know, she was about the same age as her husband, you know, we opened these crates and the paintings were badly damaged, water damage, right? They were oil paintings, but you know, the water had gotten into the canvases, and the paintings were rather badly damaged. And in some cases, we couldn't actually detach the paintings from the paper. And we had all these drying guns, you know, like they use for removing paint, or hair, you know, hair dryers at the hotel, right? We had all of this stuff. And so, you know, we were pulling these crates out and carefully taking the top off. And then and as we were inspecting everything, she was just so distressed, right? She was like, you know, she was crying. And she, and finally, you know, after the day, we didn't come back. She said, listen, you know, you guys aren't going to, no offense, but you're not going to be any help. She said, I really need to get like a specialist in here, you know, a restorer in here and see what can be done. So that was our job for the day. And it was sad, right? I mean, I was a young man. I would mostly just move furniture for people and enjoy riding in the moving truck. And I had this encounter with this couple who had this tragedy, you know. And, you know, when we were in the house, you know, I was walking around when we weren't busy, and I noticed he had a library, right? And on the shelf, there was like the Tibetan Book of the Dead. There are all these Buddhist books, you know, most of which I hadn't read at the time, but, you know, he was really like very widely read. And, you know, when we went through his room, you know, he had this beautiful smile. I don't think he was, I imagine he didn't have long to live. But he looked so happy and his eyes looked so bright that I have never forgotten, right? It's almost like, 48 years ago this happened to me, and memory plays tricks, but it was so inspiring to me. I thought, what is this guy's secret? You know, he should be utterly, you know, he should be devastated, but he doesn't look devastated. You know, he looks really happy. And it's possible he was just out of it. But I didn't get that impression from him, right? He had those bright eyes, right? You know, and I've been around people who were dying, and my father didn't have bright eyes, right? He was so sad, you know, and this guy was so, so alive, you know, even though he was just about to die. And his wife was in such emotional distress, but he seemed so serene. It stayed with me, you know. I've talked about this before too. When I was training at the Seattle Zen Center, the Genki Roshi had a friend who was also a Roshi from Japan who was staying. And the guy was dying of cancer. He had cancer and he had had connections here in the United States. I think he and Genki Roshi had like some mutual friends in the Japanese community, and he was staying at the Zen Center in Seattle. And, you know, he was a sick guy. You know, sometimes he couldn't get out of bed. You know, he was just too, it was wearing on him, right? You know, just to, you know, sometimes it just, he wouldn't be there for breakfast. You know, we would sit in the morning and he wouldn't be there because he was just too tired, you know. But sometimes he would be out and about and he was so alive. You know, it's just like, again, what is this guy's secret, you know? He just seemed so alive. And I heard that that was the case also with Suzuki Roshi, you know, at the San Francisco Zen Center. Suzuki Roshi was this man who, I've talked about this before, one of his students was mentally ill. And this was in Japan, and training at the temple. And he wasn't mentally ill a little bit. He was, you know, he was seriously ill. Basically, people were saying to him, you know, you really shouldn't let him stay at the temple. You know, he really, Suzuki Roshi said, no, you know, he's getting better. You know, anyway, he killed Suzuki Roshi's daughter. You know. So Suzuki Roshi had, like, as you can imagine, he fell into deep depression, right? You know, deep depression. Because, I mean, look, he left this guy at the temple, right? You know, and you know, he went through a long, dark period in his life, but he came out of it, and he became the teacher at the San Francisco Zen Center in this beautiful, beautiful community assembled there. And if you read Zen Mind's Beginner's Mind, it's just this masterpiece, right? It's like 80 pages of just pure enlightenment. He got cancer, right? And at a pretty young age. And I remember reading this where his students were making noodles, Japanese noodles. And, you know, they had they make a huge bunch of Japanese noodles. You mix the flour and the water and you make a big ball of dough, and then you cut those you roll it out and then you cut it into noodles. And they were doing this, and it was, you know, kind of like a noodle making party. And Mrs. Suzuki was afraid that they were making too much noise. And when Shunryu Suzuki heard this, he came through the door, and they said he was just like, it was like, you know, I want to make some noodles. You know, he was so in the moment, right? Just like so alive. And his wife kept saying, you need to go back and rest. And it's like, you know, he was just electricity itself, right? So you know, for many of us, that maybe the end is far away. But, you know, emotional distress is often with us, right? And we can be so in such distress, right? Such unhappiness, and it can be worse than illness, really, you know. So you know, this koan is really about this experience, right? It's about illness, right? But it's about much more than illness, right? Guishan asked Dao Wu, where are you coming from? He said, I've been tending the sick, you know. So Dao Wu is like, you know, one of these monks who helps people, maybe like hospice care, right? You know, so he's somebody manifesting great compassion, you know. And And, that's a wonderful thing to do, right? So, you know, when my father was like in emotional distress, you know, I really tried to get him to just calm down. And, you know, I said, you know, basically, my father was not a person to meditate, right? But I did show him how to watch his breath and try to ground himself in his breath. And I said, you know, you really have to think about others. You know, you have to think about, the people around you. And if you are, if you're basically, I mean, this might sound a little shocking, but I said, you know, if you're going into death terrified, think about what you're saying to all the people who love you. And I said, you know, it's frightening to die, but you need to put them first. You know, you need to show them that you can face this with calm, so that when their time comes to die, they can face it with calm, right? And actually, that was really good advice. You know, it really did change his behavior. You know, he really did begin to respond to things. It was like, instead of thinking about himself, he started thinking, okay, my father had, after his divorce, he had another family, had three daughters. And they were just little kids. And he was like going crazy. You know, he was like so frightened and angry. And, you know, it was like, stop and think about what you're saying to them. Now, you want to leave here with your daughters. You want them to see you, you know, grounded and facing the situation with dignity and courage, right? And he really sort of like amazingly rose to the challenge. He became a different person. You know, he would drive his daughters to school in the morning, and just because it was one of the things he could still do. He could still operate a car, and he drove them to school. They're in their 50s now, you know, and 40s and 50s, and they remember that as being these precious moments that they spent with their father, you know. So he was thinking of them, you know. So that was so wonderful, right? People who help the ill, like this monk, are really wonderful, you know. But there's something even more wonderful than telling people to think of others, which was magic in my father's case, right? You know, it's what this koan is getting at. Where Daowu said, "I've come from tending the sick." Guishan said, "How many people were sick?" And Daowu said, well, in other words, in a way, Guishan is saying, oh, what a good guy you are. How many patients did you help? And, you know, Guishan could have said 20. You know, I really worked my butt off. I was, you know, carrying bedpans and putting ice on people to cool them down. But he doesn't take that bait. Right, because there's something big. This sounds a little strange, but there's something bigger than life and death. There's something bigger than life and death. So instead of saying, bandage the sick, and he was doing those things, but he says, how many people were sick? And Daowu says, well, you know, there are the sick and the not sick. And Guishan said, aren't you the one who's not sick? So you're the not sick person helping the sick person. And so that's like conventional reality, right? That's conventional reality. So, you know, when I went to see my father, I was 40 years old. He was 69 years old. I was in good health. My father was dying. But that's conventional. So I was the healthy one helping the sick one. Right. And let's hope the healthy ones always help the sick ones, you know. But there's something more important than that. So he says, Well, weren't you the, aren't you the healthy one? And Dao Wu says, you know, whether you're healthy or not, being sick and not being sick have nothing to do with him at all. Being sick or not, you know, whether you're sick or whether you're healthy, there's, it has nothing to do with him. So who is he? Who is he? This is like the koan. Who is he? Who is he? See, the koan is saying, you know, all kinds of things happen to us. You know, some of you know, my wife has been out of the hospital now. This is, Friday will be week four of, she went in to have cataracts removed and basically they discovered a brain tumor and so a month ago they operated and successfully removed her brain tumor, right? And you know, she was basically in bed for 3 weeks, you know, and it was wonderful. She made a wonderful recovery, and it was wonderful to be able to help her, right? And get her to eat better, eat more healthy food instead of pizza all the time, right? You know, some delicious sashimi food, you know. So all good, right? You know. All of us are healthy at some point, reasonably healthy. All of us are sick at some point, you know, healthy or sick. You know, healthy or sick, have nothing to do with him, right? So have nothing to do with him. This is your Buddha nature, right? So we pay attention, you know, in Zen, there's something we talk about in Zen tradition. There's something called guest and host, right? Guest and host. So the guest consciousness is the consciousness that is caught up in the details, right? So, you know, if you go on a vacation and you book at a Airbnb or a hotel and you see all these beautiful pictures and then you get there and the place is a dump and, you know, you say, well, you know, in the picture, there was a photograph of a lake out the window. And, you know, the guy says, well, you know, there's a lake nearby, you know, it's about a mile away, right, you know. So you would be upset, justifiably upset, you know, and would be within your rights to say you have, you know, deceived me, you know. Or, you know, you could get to a place that's reasonably nice, but you could be very picky. You could say, well, it's nice, but it's not as nice as I thought, you know, or, you know, this room is smaller than I thought. You know, I thought we were going to have room for, you know, something. So that's the guest consciousness, right? The guest, we're mostly the guest, right, in our lives. You know, the guest is picky. The guest is, you know, expecting, right? And transactional. The guest is transactional. So you know, when we are going through our lives, we might decide to write, you know, you might be like Stephen King and decide to write a novel, and you take courses at the university, you take a Master's of Fine Arts courses, and you get a MFA, and you go the fiction writing workshops and. And then you write your book, and you know, while you're writing your book, you're awake every night, thrashing around, thinking, how can I make this the best book? And then you read what you wrote, and you tear it apart, and you throw it in the trash, and you rewrite it, and you cry, and finally you get the manuscript done, and you look for a book agent, and maybe no agent is interested. This actually happens to people, right? I mean, I have a friend of mine who published a lot of short stories, and he wrote this novel. He couldn't get arrested. You know, he couldn't. You know, it was so disappointing. And he, you know, you want to be famous. You want to be a great novelist. You want people to read your work and say, "Oh, this is wonderful." You know, you remind me of so and so. And instead, you can't even get it out of type. You know, out of type script. You know, so when those things happen, we feel so cheated or unhappy. We feel so low and lousy, right? And that's the guest consciousness, right? So we spend a lot of our time, me too, in guest consciousness, right? But sometimes we experience host consciousness. You know, it's like, if you go to, I still like to go, there's still some used bookstores around. And I like to go to used bookstores and look at old, like, books from the, you know, from the 19th century or 20th century. And, you know, if you know some of these, like these 19th century authors who were really famous, you know, if you go and you look at the Nobel Prize winners, you know, or you look at Pulitzer Prize winning novels in the United States, a lot of those books you've never heard of, a lot of those people you've never heard of, never. When you wrote your novel and you were lying on the bed crying because you couldn't find a publisher, it just seemed like the end of the earth. And then you go to the used bookstore and you realize these guys all found a book agent, they found a publisher, they published their work, and now it's like literally their books are going to be like ground up and used for fertilizer or something. So I'm not saying it's not worth writing the book, but you know, there's a guest consciousness and there's a host consciousness, these people that I so admire, that nameless man, when I was working for the Mayflower Moving Company, you know, I think he was in host consciousness. You know, sometimes people have great clarity at the end of their life, they realize it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You know, I was alive, and I was really alive, and now I'm going to be really dead. And you know, there's whether I'm alive or dead, there's something else here. There's something else here. You know. Actually, from the Zen standpoint, neither birth nor death is correct. You know, we say in Zen, there is no birth and no death. And people might think that's wishful thinking, but what they're really saying is as long as we identify with Kurt, there's birth and death. But when we encounter our true nature, there's no birth and there's no death. So that's not meant to be like a happy thought. You know, the Zen view is that ordinary reality, our perspective, is wrong, it's mistaken, and that the self doesn't exist in the way we thought it does, right? That it's, the self is not what we think. You know, it doesn't have many of the qualities we assign to it. And because we think the self is real and we think it, you know, exists by itself and so on, we have this very false picture. But, you know, if you have the host consciousness, the host is the person who prepares for the guest, you know, makes sure the room is clean and here, stay here, eat here, here's the food. The host knows that there's no birth and there's no death. And so, you know, no birth and no death is the way the host seems obvious to the host. So if you do a lot of zazen, you know, you begin to spend time in the host consciousness and less time in the guest consciousness, you begin to be, you know, you begin to be happier, and you begin to be less attached, and you have a kind of unshakable confidence in things, right? Like unshakable confidence, you know. It's like there always is going to be a happy ending if you are in the host consciousness, you know. So you know, basically, birth and death are real from a limited perspective of people who identify themselves as the center of their consciousness. But when you inspect consciousness, you realize you're not the center of your consciousness. So you know, when a naive person thinks, I am having thoughts, I am Kurt, Kurt is having thoughts, right? These thoughts are happening in Kurt's head. But you know, when we do meditation on the cushion, we enter periods where we're not self-referencing at all. There's awareness, there's thoughts without a thinker. There's awareness without any self-referencing. And that's not a gimmick. What you might decide is that Kurt is an idea in consciousness. Kurt is not the source of consciousness. I'm just like a character in the movie that consciousness is producing. And I'm not even Kurt most of the time. You know, sometimes I walk outside and it's just the moon and the insects, you know, outside at night chirping and making their beautiful sound. And you know, forget all about Kurt. It's consciousness without, it's thoughts without a thinker. And the Zen view is that's real. That's more real than Kurt, you know, actually. Kurt is real, he's here for a while, but he's a thought in this idea. He's a thought, see? He's not the thinker. So we're practicing being in the host consciousness. You know, we're practicing, we spend 99% of our time in guest consciousness, but when we come to Sesshin, we put ourselves in the host position. And, you know, when you, when you're working with your koan, you know, you want an answer, but the more worried you are about the answer, the less likely you are to answer the koan. You know, what you really have to do is just, it's a little hard. It takes 3 days of sitting to just give up and not be concerned about whether you get the answer or not. And just allow the koan to take you somewhere, like on a journey, you don't know where. And normally we want to control things, but when we're working with our koans, we just let the koan take us. So the koans aren't answered, they're followed. And we follow the koan where it's going, and eventually it takes us to this amazing place. You know, sometimes we never knew it was there before. So that's what this koan is all about, when you're sick, you're sick. You know, when you're healthy, but whether you're sick or healthy, how does he put it? He says, being sick and not being sick have nothing to do with him at all. See? And Dao Wu is saying, have you met him? Have you met the host? You know, you're in the guest consciousness, but do you know the host consciousness? Just speak quickly, speak quickly. And Guishan says, he says, yes, I'm there right now. Even if I could say something, it would have no relation. So, you know, whether I say yes or no, whether you get the, if you're an engineer and you're designing a bridge, it matters whether you get the math right, right? But, you know, whether you get the math right or not, there's something will always be there, no matter what. And a lot of our Zen practice is sort of discovering that right here now is the our true nature, our Buddha nature. And what we're looking here and there and in France and in South America, or we're, you know, getting PhDs. But and yes, there's a, if you get a PhD, that's good. In linguistics, be a linguist, you know, whatever. You know, if you're a chemist, be a good chemist. But there's something that's always here, whether you're a good chemist or not, right? Whether you're a good doctor or not, whether you cure the sick or not, whether you're sick or healthy. And it's that's the most important, from the Zen standpoint, that's the most important thing. It's the most liberating thing. It's like, you know, if that woman I was talking to, I mentioned, who was opening a store and said, "Will Zen help me?" If I had said, "Yes, it will help you," and her store fails, well, where is she then? I mean, really. And I would have been lying anyway, but, you know, she could do everything right and her business could still fail. I mean, that happens, right? So you know, sometimes we're in such a distress and then all of a sudden we're just free and we realize, I don't have to worry about this at all. I've been suffering so much. I've been suffering so much, and what it really brought me is it brought me to a place where I realized I don't have to suffer. You know, I've suffered so much and now I realize I got something out of it. I realize I don't have to suffer. You know, it's always right here. So in different ways, we're all there already, but it's hard to see that. We have to go through sesshin to begin to realize that. And all of you are doing exactly the right thing. You're practicing wholeheartedly. You're on a journey and you're following it. You know, in a wholehearted means without conditions or reservations. You know, you're just trusting in your big mind. You're trusting in the process. So that's magnificent. That's like a miracle. So please keep going. You're doing a wonderful job.